appellant, Mr. Tsuchida.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Brian Tsuchida for Mr. Dictato. If I may reserve 2 minutes.
Better start that clock there. Okay. Yeah.
Okay. Your Honor, there are two broad issues. First, whether Mr. Dictato's petition is time-barred. And second, if not, whether the Court should grant a COA and relief on the uncertified IAC claim. The first issue, Your Honor, follows the Court's request for supplemental briefing regarding the effect of Pace versus DiGalimo. And I think, as the Court can see from that decision, that it forecloses statutory tolling under 2244 D2, which was the original ground to allow merits consideration in this case. Pace, of course, did not address the issue of equitable tolling, and really that really has not been explored.
Right. So, and the district court didn't address that because, as I understand it, the district court thought the statute was tolled.
Well, that's correct. This is a rather odd set of circumstances. The whole issue of the statute of limitations came up after opening briefs were submitted originally in 2004. This year, the court ordered supplemental briefing regarding the effect of Pace, which was decided last year. Magistrate Judge Benton and the district court addressed the current petition on the merits. And, of course, the district court granted a partial COA regarding an amendment issue.
Well, just to cut to the chase, would it be correct, in light of Pace, for us to vacate the decision that was rendered below and then to remand to the district court to consider equitable tolling?
I think that would be correct, Your Honor. I also think that, in addition to that, the court has to decide what it's in addition to the statute of limitations issue, whether there is an issue for the district court to consider.
Right. If we thought there was no issue for the district court to consider,
then a remand
then,
would.
Then we shouldn't remand.
That's correct, because a remand would simply mean there would be nothing to review. The court would find out whether or not Mr. Dictato was entitled to equitable tolling, but then in terms of any issues on which he could be granted relief, there'd be none.
Then maybe you ought to address your argument to whether there is an issue that requires the remand for equitable tolling.
As the court knows, there are essentially two issues, a certified issue and an uncertified issue. I'm not going to really dwell on the certified issue because that is essentially addressed by Mayo versus Felix, and I don't think there's much to say beyond that. However, on the uncertified issue, we would ask the court to grant a COA, remand that issue to the district court with direction for an evidentiary hearing. That is an ineffective assistance of counsel claim. Just in terms of a nutshell of that claim, as the court recalls, there were three defendants in two separate trials. Defendants Ramil and Galoy were convicted for the actual shooting of two victims, Viernes and Domingo. Their trial occurred before Mr. Dictato's trial. Ramil and Galoy gave affidavits indicating they're willing to testify on behalf of Mr. Dictato and that their testimony would be Mr. Dictato didn't have anything to do with the shooting. The claim, of course, had to do with whether Mr. Dictato's trial lawyer was ineffective for failing to both investigate and call these witnesses. And the court should order a COA on this.
Assuming we do that and we reach the merits, then how is the state court decision wrong?
Several different levels. I think, first, the state court leapt to some conclusions which are simply not supported by the record. And to that extent, the state court findings of fact were unreasonable. And I think if there was something in the record to support the state court's assessment that these witnesses would not have essentially been not credible, I think the words they used were things like, well, the witnesses might have been more equivocal than Mr. Dictato postulates. Well, there's nothing in the record to support that really speculative statement. All we had in terms of what was before the state court were Mr. Dictato's affidavit and the affidavits of Ramil and Galloy. And they were not ambiguous. They were quite unequivocal.
Don't we presume that the trial lawyer's decision was tactical?
Well, there is a body of law that says that there should be that presumption, but normally that needs to also be supported by some facts. Now, there are also, in some ways, facts and law that cut exactly against that.
But weren't these accomplices appealing their convictions?
They were appealing their convictions.
The real question about availability to begin with, would they have testified?
Well,
in the face
that
of
was
appeal?
Never developed because in the state proceedings there really was no discovery, there was no evidentiary hearing. In a vacuum, the state court sort of made these assumptions about their availability. There's nothing to say they were not available. And the only thing in the record were the affidavits of these two witnesses who said
long after the fact.
That's true. But of course, Mr. Dictato,
you have to go back. You have to look at what was going on at the time of trial, not at the time they write the affidavits.
Well, at the time of trial, Mr. Dictato's affidavit is indicated that he had told his lawyer that he wanted the lawyer to investigate these witnesses and to call them. And that was never done. And that is all that's in the record. There's nothing that indicates the lawyer made a tactical decision. And I think this is also where it's clearly contrary. You could not say that there was a tactical decision where there's nothing to show that there was a reasonable investigation. Both Strickland and Wiggins both hold. It would be clearly contrary to established Supreme Court law that no tactical decision could ever be made without some type of reasonable investigation. And on this record, none was made. I think
is it a question of lack of a showing, or is there an affirmative showing that the lawyer did not investigate?
Well, the only thing in the record regarding that is Mr. Dictato's declaration or affidavit, which he says, I asked him to do it, and he didn't do it. Mr. Ramil, Mr. Galloy's declaration says, we were never called. It indicates there was no real contact between them and Mr. Dictato's trial lawyer. As I said, one of the problems, of course, is making these sort of firm decisions in an absence of any kind of evidentiary hearing process. Now, we had in fact argued in the district court that this is exactly the kind of claim that merited an evidentiary hearing. Clearly.
Excuse me 1 minute, Mr. Dennis. We have feedback of an echo. Okay, thank you. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Clearly, Mr. Dictato had made or presented a colorable claim of ineffective assistance. He was denied or never had an evidentiary hearing, and this is exactly the type of claim that should have gone to an evidentiary hearing to develop the facts. There's no indication that he failed to develop or he was not diligent, so there are no 2254E2 prohibitions for the evidentiary hearing in the district court. Mind you, there are also problems in terms of what legal standard the state court utilized, even, for instance, on the prejudice prong of the Strickland claim.
Did you want to reserve any time for rebuttal?
I did, Your Honor, and I think my time is up, so I will just
stop. I'm sorry, but we are going to have to keep everyone right on schedule today in light of some of the schedules we've got. So go ahead, please, Mr. Sampson.
May it please the Court, John Sampson, Assistant Attorney General representing the respondent. In this case, the petition is untimely under the federal statute of limitations. This Court, in its original opinion on the first appeal, found that the opinion was untimely. Then, in light of the R2's case, reconsidered that opinion and found that because of the 1997 state collateral challenge, there was statutory tolling. The Supreme Court now has reversed this Court's decision on that particular issue, and under Pace, there was no statutory tolling. The petition.
What about equitable tolling?
There has been no showing whatsoever of any basis for equitable tolling, and I would point out that on the
But in a situation where the petitioner has no basis for thinking that he's entitled to equitable tolling because he doesn't need it, wouldn't the lack of a record be very understandable?
No, Your Honor, for two reasons. The first is that on the first direct appeal, this court, in the opinion that was withdrawn, found that Mr. Dictato had waived his arguments for equitable tolling because he never raised them in the opening brief on the first appeal when the issue was the timeliness of the petition. Second, even in a supplemental brief now, he has not presented any facts showing equitable tolling. He's simply said remand for the district court to consider it. He's provided no offer of proof that he has a basis for equitable tolling.
Well, if the district court didn't address it here, why does he have to say something other than remand?
Because there's no showing of error entitling him to a remand unless he presents some evidence to show the district court.
In terms of error, the district court didn't have to address equitable tolling because of the statutory theory. Normally, we wouldn't be addressing an issue that the district court hadn't addressed without letting the district court look at it first. So what's different from your point of view here from the normal course where we take an issue like equitable tolling, the district court didn't address it, and we send it back and district court looks at it first?
Although in the very beginning, back in prior to this court's initial opinion on appeal, the district court did address the issueliness of the petition. This court held on that first direct appeal that the petitioner waived the issue of equitable tolling, and now at this very late date he says I'm entitled to it without any showing for it. I think that is a reason why.
Is that the law of the case? Is it not under that doctrine?
The intervening decision by the U.S. Supreme Court in Pace circumvents or is an exception to the law of the case, and that's why law of the case does not bar consideration of the timeliness of the petition. It puts us essentially back where we were in the first appeal, where the district court said this petition is untimely and the petitioner is trying to overcome that finding. There's been no showing of equitable tolling, and even on a remand, there'd be no showing. He was the one claim they pursue now is the ineffective assistance of counsel claim. That claim was exhausted in state court in the early 1990s at the time of the first personal restraint petition. He could have filed a petition at that time raising the claim in federal court. He chose not to do so. He chose to wait and file two untimely petitions in state court, file a third untimely, or actually his fourth untimely petition in state court, and then come to federal court after the statute of limitations had expired. Because the petition's untimely, the court cannot reach the claim of ineffective assistance counsel. I can address that claim if the court has any questions regarding that substantive claim of ineffective assistance counsel, but we would argue that the petition itself is untimely and therefore no relief is available.
No questions here.
We would ask the court then to affirm the denial of habeas relief on the basis that the petition is untimely. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Unless the court has questions, I have no further argument.
What's your response to the argument that there's already essentially been a finding of waiver in the first go-around?
I think, though, that finding of waiver is limited in terms of whether or not it could be argued on appeal. I believe the exact words were in the first opinion was that for purposes of that appeal, the petitioner had waived it by raising it in the reply brief rather than in the opening brief. So I don't think it could be construed that that whole issue is waived.
So what resurrects it?
Well, as the AG has just said, the only reason we're talking about statute of limitations right now is we're starting back to ground zero, as if this was in the first instance. And so I think also in terms of the equities of what's happened, this is such an odd case because of the timing of when the issue has come up. In many respects, Mr. Dictato's case has been fractured, pre-R2s, post-R2s. Here we are on an appeal of the merits. The statute of limitations comes up after the merits determination. So I think that given the sort of peculiar and unique circumstances in this case, and the court now asking to address a statute of limitations question, that it would be fair and appropriate to allow.
Is there a hint in the record of a factual basis for equitable tolling in this case?
I think that it never really got developed, and I think that's why it should be remanded back to the district court.
In Bonner against Kerry, the argument was that the discussion between the petitioner and the district court got confused enough that equitable tolling was never really explained. But here, according to the state, it's pretty clear that equitable tolling simply isn't there. The time had run, and no claim that somebody had misled him into letting the time run.
Stacey, the clock isn't running.
And I guess my problem is that it's very difficult to respond to an argument about raising a new argument outside of the record for the first time on equitable tolling.
All right. Thank you.
Okay. Dictato versus Ducharme shall be submitted.